Well, good morning, everybody. This is Lenny Lawson, the car guru. I'm glad to be here with you this morning. I'm broadcasting from my office, the command post here at Gateway Ford and Gateway Nissan in Greenville, Tennessee. I was reminded on Friday the power of Facebook in a good way for this particular instance. I posted three pictures of three different vehicles, and within 1 hour, two of those vehicles were sold. It just blows me away. And it was not sold to the people who were like on my Facebook page. They referred it to somebody else or forwarded it to someone else of their friends, and they called and bought a Bronco Sport and a Ford Mustang. And so this internet thing, I think it's going to be around for a while. I remember the early days of that, and people would say, Lenny, or these people would come in to see me at my office and said, Mr. Lawson, you need to set up a web page. And I said, well, what's a web page? Well, it's this, it's a virtual car dealership. I said, well, what's that? And that would just continue. I remember the same thing with email. Now, what exactly is email? Now, what is a text message? Is it like using a pager? No, not exactly. And I was digging around in one of my drawers. I've got a lot of drawers with junk. And I found one of my old cell phones. And I'm just looking at this thing. It was an old BlackBerry. And one of the original BlackBerries. And I'm thinking, I actually used this and made phone calls with this thing. And I look at that compared to my iPhone 11 Plus Pro or whatever it's called. And it's just, we've come a long way as far as technology. And in automobiles, too. I had a gentleman in the showroom on Friday, and he had purchased a Ford F-150 Power Boost. That's the hybrid F-150, and he'd purchased it at one of our competitors. And so he was in the showroom, came all the way to Gateway just to get an explanation on how the thing worked. He said that nobody at that dealership knew how it worked. Now, I don't necessarily believe that, but that's okay. He actually lives in Bull's Gap, so it's kind of right between Greenville and Morristown. So he had purchased this vehicle somewhere south of here, southwest, and decided to try to figure out what this whole electric thing and how he plugs it into his house. And I went through the whole explanation about how that works and what the truck is capable of. And he said he was watching TV, and one of the reasons he bought the truck is that he could power his house. And I explained to him, well, you know, there's a little asterisk beside that claim. Yes, you can power part of your house. You can't power probably both of your heat pumps and your washer and dryer and your dishwasher and your refrigerator and your hot water heater all at the same time. You're going to have to pick and choose. And so it's basically an emergency generator. And let me explain to you how you have to have your house wired. So that's what I proceeded to do. I had to do the research myself. And I have been driving one of these hybrid F-150s for several weeks now. And I am just amazed at the fuel economy, the way it transitions from electric power to gas power and back. It is so seamless and been very impressed with it. You know, if you camp or if you are concerned, you know, you don't have a generator for your home for emergency use, it might be a way to solve both issues. Camping, it can provide power up to 30 amps of power, which will power most campers. My particular camper has two air conditioners and hot water heater and refrigerator, and it requires 50 amps, but not all the time. And so I could basically, if there was no plug-in at the campsite, then I could pretty much run everything. I could run everything at once, but I could run one air conditioner and everything else with my pickup truck, and it'll run for 45 hours on a full tank of gas. It's pretty amazing. So before you go out and buy a F-150 Power Boost, we've got like four of them in stock right now. Before you go out and buy one, make sure you understand what it's going to cost to wire your house for that, because you do have to get off the power grid somehow. You have to have some type of a switch that will enable you to not draw power from the utility and draw power from a secondary source like a generator or this truck. So that's probably not a cheap conversion, but I've been told it can cost anywhere from $1,000 to $1,500. That may be high or low, so I'd have to do some research on that. But still, if you do a lot of camping or you are concerned about maybe Armageddon happening and you want some power, at least for 45 hours, then this might be a good alternative. Okay, I was looking in the news this morning, just reading some of the stuff that I get from NADA, National Auto Dealers Association, and they're talking about following Hurricane Ida, some dealers in the Northeast are lobbying automakers to give priority to their lots for restocking vehicles to help owners in affected areas. New Jersey Coalition of Automotive Retailers says that many dealerships in New Jersey were already carrying 10% less of their normal ground stock. That's baloney. They were probably carrying a lot less than that. But now they're saying that thousands of vehicles on dealership lots were destroyed, totaled, and will probably end up going to the crusher. Same thing in New Orleans. I warned you folks about anytime you see a big event like this, just be careful when you're buying used cars about anywhere from 2 to 6 months later and check and see where they came from. Because if they came from the Northeast or, you know, anywhere around the Gulf Coast there, you could be buying a car that's been underwater. So just we want to make sure that does not happen to you. Also, a lot of manufacturers are shutting down and cutting back. General Motors said that they're getting ready to reopen their Silverado plant, so you Chevy Silverado buyers might have something to choose from. Toyota is slashing a production goal again by 330,000 more units. I think they already cut out another 400,000. The total hit represents about a 40% cutback from the Toyota's original October production plan. So this is happening to every automaker, and you know what it is. It's that doggone chip shortage, and it is being exacerbated by the Delta variant. I can't believe all this terminology I've had to come acquaint myself with that has changed the vernacular. We are now talking about things that we never thought we would ever talk about. But that's just the way life rolls, isn't it? Well, I'm going to take my first break, and I'll be back here in just a minute. Okay, I'm back. I am going to talk about a little bit of history, go back in time. You know, sometimes I just get tired of all the tech. My wife would not agree. She would think that I'm addicted to tech. And to a certain degree, I am a early adopter, always have been. You know, if something new comes out, I want it. But the older I've gotten, the more nostalgic I've become. And I like looking back and thinking about, you know, when things started and what has changed, how it came about. Looking back at the industry, automobiles weren't born in the 20th century. They actually started in the late 19th century. But a guy named Gottlieb Daimler and his buddy, Carl Benz, you've recognized that name probably, they introduced an improved four-stroke internal combustion engine, had a big impact on the new auto industry, which really wasn't an industry at that point. But autos in both the United States and in Europe were really poking along at just a few miles an hour. They didn't have any kind of a battery starter. They didn't have a roof. They didn't even have windows, and they were expensive. And then good old Henry Ford fine-tuned the mass production of his Tin Lizzie, and the world drove off into the age of affordable transportation. You know, you think about how distances shrunk when men were able to get off of their feet and get on horses, and then they shrunk again, or shrank. Shrunk or shrank. People started moving around a lot more, going from one place to another, going on vacations. You know, the idea of vacations was spawned by the automobile and the development of motels and hotels, places to stay. I mean, it's just a very interesting history and the impact that the car has had and continues to have. Just looking back at some of the innovations that have happened over the decades, 1901 was actually when Oldsmobile started production in Detroit. Ransom E. Olds. He contracted with some outside companies for parts and helped him to originate mass production techniques before Henry Ford. Olds produced 425 cars in its first year of operation. The first was the 3-horsepower curved dash Oldsmobile, and it sold for $650, which was a lot of money back then. The car is a success. Olds is selling 5,000 units a year by 1905. And then in 1908, that's when Henry began making the Model T as far as the assembly line production. First year production of the Model T was 10,660 cars. And if you wanted it to start, you had to stand in front of it and turn a crank. It wasn't until 1911 that the electric starter was introduced. 1913, the moving assembly line for automobiles was developed at Ford Motor Company and really changed the whole game. The Highland Park, Michigan plant produced 300,000 cars in 1914. Big jump from 10,660, huh? It took until 1914, though, for the first car body to be made entirely of steel. Many of the cars were actually made out of wood. There are still some cars produced today not the outside of the car, but the inside of the car is actually made out of wood. And that company is called Morgan, and they're made in England. And if you want one, you can buy one. 1919 was an interesting year. It was the first foot pedal that would operate four-wheel brakes. Now, they were not hydraulic. They were operated by cables, and that's not real comforting, but that's the way it was. 1922 was the first car with four-wheel hydraulic brakes, so that when you put your foot on a brake pedal, you're pushing on fluid, which is going to a caliper or a drum brake of some kind that would stop the car. First power steering showed up in a Pierce Arrow, which was a brand of vehicle for rich people. It worked by integrating the steering linkage with a hydraulic system. But that was 1926, and then it was 1931 for the first modern independent front suspension system. Mercedes-Benz was the first modern independent system. It gave cars a much smoother ride, better handling, made each front wheel virtually independent of the other, which has been in common use today. Now we have most cars have four-wheel independent suspensions. Most pickup trucks don't. They still have a solid axle. I know a Jeep, for example, Jeep Wrangler, still uses a solid front and rear axle. So very common in heavy-duty vehicles. The new Bronco, that was rumored that it was going to have a solid front and rear, but they decided to go with an independent front, which gives it a better ride and handling characteristics. But that all came about in 1931. You know, you think of front-wheel drive as being something that is exclusively, relatively new. I remember when Chevrolet came out with the Chevy Citation, yuck, in 1981. But General Motors built the Toronado. I think that was their first mass-produced front-wheel drive car. But the front-wheel drive car was not a new concept. As a matter of fact, Miller built Indianapolis race cars that were front-wheel drive. And that was back in the 20s and late teens. But the first successful mass-produced front-wheel drive car was not built in the United States. It was built in France. A Citroën, or Citroën, or as I used to say, Citroën, because I didn't know any better, they built a car called the Traction Avant, and it was the first successful mass-produced front-wheel drive car. And then you had, in the United States, you had Cord. Did you know that there was a car called a Cord? It was built by the Auburn company. Matter of fact, they merged together called Auburn Cord, and they're out of Auburn, Indiana, and it was the first United States company to offer front-wheel drive. Here's a few other milestones. The first air conditioning system in cars, when do you think that was? Way back in 1939. 1950s, the cruise control was developed. A guy named Ralph Teeter, a blind man, senses by ear that cars on the Pennsylvania Turnpike travel at uneven speeds, which he believed leads to accidents. So through the 40s, he developed a cruise control mechanism that a driver could set to hold the car at a steady speed. It wasn't very popular generally until in the late 50s. Cruise control was now standard on more than 70% of today's automobiles, but a blind man came up with cruise control. You know, and then the efforts to really curb emissions started in the 60s, mostly the late 60s. That's when the PCV valve came along. So that stands for positive crankcase ventilation. And what it does, and then we still use them today, it routes gases back to the cylinders from the exhaust for further combustion. And with the introduction of catalytic converters in the 70s, hydrocarbon emissions, which were the ones causing the smog for the most part, were reduced by 95%. And so that's compared to emissions in 1967. So a lot of this was spurred by the government, but automakers were in tune with accomplishing this. But they kept cranking down the screws, so to speak. And that's what happened in the early 70s and through part of the, I guess most of the 70s and into the early 80s until fuel injection came along. They kept making cars get worse fuel economy and terrible drivability issues. Hesitation was one of the worst. I remember as a service advisor working at the Chevy store, that was the number one complaint that customers had is their cars would hesitate when they would try to, you know, take off from a dead stop or try to accelerate. And, you know, and the horsepower was minimal back then. And then when they came out with fuel injection, finally they were able to get more control with computers and things like that to monitor the air and fuel combination. And today, you know, it's just amazing that we can have a car like a Chevy Corvette, for example, that has, 600 or 700 horsepower that will still get close to 30 miles to the gallon on the highway. It's just nothing short of amazing what the engineering advances have created as far as engine performance is concerned. You know, I've talked about it on this radio show a lot. If you ever have an opportunity to go through an auto assembly plant, it is amazing. Any kind of plant, for that matter. There's a new Miller Industries plant down here. They build wrecker bodies and stuff like that here in Greenville. And I was able to go through their personalized plant tour with the plant manager not too long ago. And it is fascinating. But to actually see all this come together in an assembly plant is a totally different deal and experience. Back in the 80s, the Japanese popularized just-in-time delivery. You may have heard of that, but that's when an auto part that's getting ready to be placed on a vehicle on the assembly line comes just at the right time. It eliminates the need for big inventories of parts, regardless of what type of part. In an assembly plant, they're able to. I watch workers put in seats and hang on doors and install radios and stuff. And they just turn around and right there it is, and they turn right to the car and install it. And they maybe look at a piece of paper or a computer screen for an instant, but exactly what they need is right at the right place at the right time. And that really increased the efficiency of plants. But that's really what's exacerbated this chip shortage problem, because when the automakers canceled all of their orders, it completely shut down a lot of aspects of that industry. And so especially the part that was supplying chips to the auto industry, because all of them stopped ordering. And it takes a long time to get the chips back online, because it's a very complicated manufacturing process, much more so than stamping out a fender or something like that. So now here we find ourselves with very low inventories, with rising inflation, higher transaction prices on automobiles, and just terrible supply problems. So sometimes you create a system that is dependent upon just in time, and when you have a disruption like that, it shuts down everything. and we can't build cars, especially for a vital part like that. We'll take our last break and be back here in just a minute. Okay, just as a reminder, if you bought a new vehicle in the last 30 days or, you know, 6 months, you're going to be getting some pieces of mail. It's not exactly junk mail because they have your name on it and they have your vehicle that you bought and stuff, and it's from somebody trying to sell you an extended warranty. Take those pieces of paper and throw them into garbage. If you want to buy an extended warranty, buy it from the dealer where you bought your vehicle. These aftermarket warranties, these warranty companies, they even send out these notices that says, your warranty is about to expire. You know, you may get that a year or so after you bought your vehicle, but those are solicitations. And they sound a little scary because of the way they phrase it. And I get phone calls every week. Somebody asked me about this notice that they got, and they think it came from the manufacturer, and it did not. So if you get something like that, snap a picture of it, send it to me. I'll be glad to look it over, but it is not what you need. You need to go back to the dealership and buy a service contract from them. Especially if you bought a Ford, buy a Ford contract. If you bought a Nissan, buy a Nissan contract. You know, these are things that have better overall coverage, and now there are different levels of coverage. And if you want a bumper-to-bumper warranty, which really there is no such thing because it doesn't cover the bumpers, but if you want the most complete warranty you can buy, that's going to be the most expensive. If you want something that covers specific components, they're much cheaper, but I don't recommend them. Buy something that is the most coverage, and then you're less likely to be disappointed when you go in for a claim. Well, that's it for this show, and we'll be back and see you tomorrow for another edition of My Car Guru.